Hello and welcome to the Talking Locks with Lockitude podcast. This is another episode of Chair Convos. I still have allergies and I am here with E, the producer of the Talking Locks with Lockitude podcast. Hi E, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, otherwise known as E the Mastermind.
E the Mastermind. So, there's so many things I would like to talk about. I'm already excited and smiling from ear to ear. Where's a good place to start? The hair. So tell us, what's happening with your hair right now?
My hair right now, I'm just growing it out. Been growing it out for about since COVID year. And, you know, I have the whole high top with the fade in the side, but I get it retwisted constantly. So that's what's going on with my hair.
So you are one of the people with loose hair to have the privilege of making it onto the Talking Locks with Lockitude podcast. We have been courting you for a while now. I believe sometime last year or two, I wrote a whole letter to you about why you should lock your hair. It was a nice letter.
It was.
So if you haven't read the letter I wrote to E, you can find it as one of the previous episodes. It's a letter to E on 7 reasons to lock your hair. And you showed me a poll that you put out on Instagram recently.
Yeah, just last night, and I was considering it. I've been thinking about, like, you know, I'm always retwisting it, and I'm not quite getting the length I want because of the shrinkage. So I'm like, I might as well just lock it because I'm not doing anything else with it. I never twist it out like I say I'm going to. And apart for Halloween, I don't wear my hair out. So I put a little poll out. The options were, you know, should I lock it? And the options were, what are you waiting for? And nah, you never know. And so far, what are you waiting for was winning in the polls.
Okay.
You know, by about 65% or so.
I'll take that. Those are good odds. I'm never going to pressure you on this podcast. When you're ready, you'll be ready. And I'm here for you.
What I'm thinking about doing is play around with different styles first that I've just never done before. And if I don't care for the versatility, I'll just go ahead and make that commitment.
Whatever style you're going to do, you can achieve it with your hair locked. But I'll just leave it there. I'll leave it there. So your brother was the first person to be on the Chair Convos podcast with me. This must have been last year. I think that's when we started it, like late last year. I know we tried to get the first episode out October 1st. And that was a great conversation. So you already have competition.
I would consider it competition, but we can call it that.
Okay. I would still talk about your sister because that's how we met. And oftentimes I usually talk about how we got to meet. So do you want to say that story? What was it from your perspective when you heard about Lockitude?
So from my perspective, again, I believe it was COVID year. We had been going to somebody previously, without mentioning the name. She had a suite here in Maryland, but also a suite in New York. She was very, very booked and busy. So it was starting to get hard to even book with her. And sometimes you would book with her, but you don't get her. You get somebody else, which that's not like, she doesn't tell you that. And so at some point we were talking about that and how it's hard to get an appointment. And we're just all in the room, and my sister's like, oh, well, my friend Ade from Nigeria just moved over here, and she just opened up a suite in Silver Spring. You guys should book. So immediately, I opened up, looked it up. I'm like, okay, cool. And I booked an appointment. I guess my brother did it at the same time as well. I didn't realize that, you know, when she said you had just opened up, that you had literally, like,
just opened.
Like, you hadn't even really even announced that it was open. So I was literally like your first or second customer.
I was very happy to wake up that morning because I think those bookings happen like at night.
Yeah.
Or the system also kind of doesn't give me immediate messages past a certain time.
Yeah.
So like past 10 p.m. I stop getting messages from the booking system, and 9 a.m. the following morning, whatever bookings come through overnight kind of comes to the phone. And so that morning at 9 a.m. I saw not one booking, but two bookings. And I was like, whoa, Americans are not joking. But I was so happy. So RSA, thank you so much. Your brothers have been faithful to Locatives since you introduced them. And like a joke, it's almost been 2 years since that happened. It feels like yesterday. But I can't believe, did I say 2 years? This is 2024. Almost 3 years,
yeah.
Actually, almost 3 years since that happened. Okay, so now that we've gotten the hair out of the way, and we know that sometime in the future, you're going to become a lockhead because you've been listening to so many podcasts as you produce them, and you've been having great conversations, or you've been listening in on the great conversations we've been having. So I'm sure you know that the lockhead is the type of person you want to be. Not that there's any stereotype around us, but... let's talk about your career. You are, what are you actually? What's the right word? Are you a producer? Are you, what is it? What is it you do?
So what I call myself, what my role is, I'm an audio engineer.
Okay.
That's what I do as an audio engineer. You know, I record audio. There's not just music. I record audio. I also do the editing. In music term, that's mixing and mastering. So that's primarily what I do, is record, mix, and master. But it's not always music, like I say. Sometimes I've worked on, people have done small documentaries, so I've done some audio for film. I edit audiobooks, which my sister, once again, she's now doing audiobooks. She narrates audiobooks, so I edit her
work.
Hey,
RSA.
And yeah, that's what I do. And I don't just work out of a studio. I built a studio and I own the studio.
That's awesome.
So
yeah, and
shout
I
out to the Mastermind Studio. Shameless plug right now. Located in Gettysburg, Maryland.
It's a very nice studio. It's a very nice space as well. I really do like the space. Sometimes I wish, like, I was like, oh, if this was maybe around where I lived, it would have been nice to have the Locatives studio as part of that studio, so people come make their hair and at the same time get... It's a very lovely space. I like that double volume space. I like the way you've done it out, the padding on the wall, the skylights. Yeah, that's my architecture background shining through there. But I really do like the space. I wish we could actually record the podcast episodes in your studio because it makes me feel like I'm recording as opposed to at the Locatives studio. However... this recording, I'm actually chilled. Usually I'm behind the chair, the customer is on the chair. It's more real, but there's something I miss about being in the studio where the intent of the conversation is just about the hair. And so let me just describe what's happening right now. He's getting a hot oil treatment, so I'm having the chance to sit down. You're probably going to hear the timer go off very soon, and I'm going to try as much as possible to keep this recording original. So we would go from the chair while we're waiting and chilling to the washbowl. So you probably hear some water, and he's going to make that water sound nice before we go into the styling chair to get his hair styled. Okay, so I've said a lot. We've talked about your career, but would you consider yourself an artist as well?
I'm definitely an artist. Before I was ever an audio engineer, I was an artist first. I've been doing this since very young. People always ask me, like, oh, when did you start? Truthfully, I would say the roots of me and music go all the way back to about 4 or 5. So if you're not familiar what sampling is, in music, you might hear a tune from the older days reworked into a new sound. You know, so I'm trying to think of an example right now. It's not coming to head, but...
Well, the Wu-Tang Clan, did I get that right?
Yeah, Wu-Tang Clan did a lot of sampling.
Yeah.
So it would take old, like, you know, 70s records, 60s records, and then use the vocal chops and the drums from the those old records, slow it down, speed it up to make new music.
Yeah.
So I'm talking about that because at the age of 4 or 5, you know, I would watch whatever cartoons, whatever I was watching, and, you know, I'm not on a computer making beats, but I would hear what I'm hearing, like the Super Mario beat, and like make a beat out of it in my head. Then I would say that's the earliest roots. Then I consider poetry a form of art. I've always kind of been a poet since I was young. And that naturally became songwriting and rapping. But before I actually wrote, I just used to freestyle. You know, freestyling, I think, is something that I guess, for the most part, a lot of young black men just kind of all do when you're growing up young, at least in the circles
part of the
I was
culture.
In. So whether or not you're a good freestyler or not, it's just something we did sometimes. So I would freestyle when I was young, like 8, 9. And I would say all my music artistry really started around when I was 8 or 9. Used to go to Thanksgiving in Ohio with a bunch of family, mostly from my mom's side, and 18 grandchildren, so all 18 cousins over there. And I had a lot of older cousins. One of my cousins was, he went to Berklee School of Music, and he used this program called Fruity Loops to make beats. And one day I asked him, like, you know, what is this? You know, how do you use this? So he showed me a couple little things. And then I've always kind of been a smart kid, so I was able to kind of somehow figure out how to construct beats. So in the time span of being there for 3 or 4 days that he let me use a computer, I made like 4 to 5 beats that we put on a CD. And he was impressed. My dad heard it. He was impressed. And he got me to start using GarageBand. We had Apple computers, so I couldn't use Fruity Loops. Fruity Loops wasn't available on Apple computers back then. Mm-hmm. So I started using GarageBand at home to continue making my own beats and learning how to do that. So I just kept going from there. And then on the flip side, my other cousin recognized that I could like freestyle pretty well. So he was like, yo, you need to start just listening to beats. When you freestyle something, write it down. Freestyle something, write it down. I always remember the first time he like had me sit down and start writing. He was like, he heard me listen to a song called The Potion by Ludacris. This is like back in 04, 05, one of those years. Wow, 20 years ago. It's weird for me to say that right now. But Sakura, it's like a vivid memory. And it was like, even while Ludacris is rapping, he's like, just ignore that. Just listen to the beat and write. So that's when it started. And that's when I really like, by middle school, every day I was trying to produce something. I'm writing. I had this little journal that's still somewhere out there where, you know, I was writing pencil and paper, writing lyrics, writing, making beats. And, you know, it wasn't always the best sounding stuff, you know, some cool sounding stuff, but
so now is a good time to actually say that I am on one of your records.
Yeah, so that's
as
true.
As tone deaf as I am.
So now we can go from there to there. Now, mind you, let me just preface on this podcast. I can sometimes give long-winded answers. All she does is like, do you consider yourself an artist? And I brought you guys back to 20 years of history. It's for a reason, though. So now, in a position I am, having a studio working with many different artists, I have the privilege of producing for artists and bringing them together, kind of like DJ Khaled does with a bunch of different artists. So yes, Ade is featured on a song called Chop Chop, which
yes.
is released under the artist's name, The Mastermind Music. And that record features about 4 different artists, and Ade is on the intro.
Yes!
So check out Chop Chop by The Mastermind Music. That voice you hear in the beginning is Ade.
As in, when I got asked to do that intro, I was like, yeah, mama, I made it. Now I can add, like, you know, music to my career. But hey, we'll see. We'll see. Okay. So I think the appropriate term for your type, let me put it that way, is a first generation immigrant in America, which means you were born here to Nigerian parents.
Correct.
Okay. How Nigerian do you feel?
I feel very Nigerian because I was born here, but I was born here for the passport. You know, like my mom was literally pregnant in Nigeria. And, you know, the story goes that he told my mom, like, look, you better go have this boy in the States, you know, because it's getting close now. I don't want to hear any stories, you know. My dad traveled a lot when he was younger. And he just wanted us to have that freedom and not have dealing with all this visa, because U.S. passport, you can basically go anywhere.
Yeah, I can even give you the numbers. I looked at it the other day. So as a US citizen, you could travel pretty much visa-free or at least visa on arrival to 172 countries. As a Nigerian citizen, you need visas to 175 countries.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work. A lot of barriers to...
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
I get it.
That's why everybody's being American is definitely a privilege.
Marry an American. But, yeah, so I say all that to say this, that I tasted the sorrow, as they say, for about the first 2.5 years of my life before my mom finally took us all and moved over here proper. And within the household, it was still very Nigerian. You know, up until I was about 5, my grandmother was alive and living with us. So, you know... growing up with my mom, we're hearing Igbo in the house.
Your pigeon is pretty solid sometimes.
Yeah, you know, the pigeon, I even picked up on the pigeon more so.
Later.
From traveling to Nigeria and just listening and, you know, being active and wanting to be prideful and being Nigerian. You know, although growing up at first, it's that same sort of thing where you can feel some alienation or the people are making fun of you for being African. Although now it's cool to be African, you know.
Well,
now
it's like, oh my God,
you're Nigerian. You know what I mean?
Do you know Burna Boy?
Do you know Malik Berry?
I'm like, yeah, he was my neighbor when I was growing up. Cool. And how American do you feel?
How American do I feel? At this point, also pretty much very American. I think I can pretty much code switch pretty easily. And I also have, I don't want to say the privilege, but I guess just the thing of where a lot of people think I don't look African. So they're even surprised to hear, like, they think I look, like, I've even been told by other, like, Black Americans, like, oh, you don't look African, whatever that means. I don't know if it's the shape of the head or whatever. You know what I mean? Sometimes people do look African. I get what they're saying. But they say I don't look African. So I blend in very well.
Well, I can see because, like, if you... General West African features, we have flatter, wider, broader noses, darker skin sometimes. So... And then East African is a specific feature. So, which... You don't necessarily have all of that going on. So I can see why somebody could feel that you don't necessarily look African because your nose is more pointed. Your skin is a bit lighter.
That's what my mom always says. She always says that your nose is pointed like the Kenyans. She's like, I don't know where you get it from.
She's the only one we could ask. She's the only one who can tell us where you got it from.
Yes, I have that going for me. And then I also feel like growing up here, even if you are like firstborn immigrant, whatever, especially when you're like me, it's like you're always approached as a Black American. So you have to learn to be one, you know? So it's amongst Black Americans, you don't know I'm Nigerian. If you're gonna be like, you know, we. And I believe there's solidarity in the Black diaspora, but there also are a lot of differences.
Yeah.
But I've also learned to like, all right, I can't just be separating myself all the time, you know? So I had to even learn to understand what it is to be Black American as I'm growing up here. That makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense, especially when you say we. So for me, who's a more recent adult immigrant, I catch myself saying you people a lot because I'm like, you know, there's you people, there's we people, there's... You people who are like Nigerian Americans, there's you people African Americans, there's you people Ethiopian Americans. So there's always like you people. There's a lot of you people here. So I can imagine that the difference, there's a lot of similarities, differences, intersects. It's a whole breed of different types of Homo sapiens, if I put it that way.
Exactly. So there's a lot of times growing up where people are speaking about certain experiences and, you know, this is this. And I'm really sitting there like, I don't know how to tell you this, but it's not the same.
That's not the same.
I can pick and choose where I can relate to, but, you know, sometimes you just gotta sit quiet and just understand versus, you know, so.
So you have been in, and it feels like your family is musically inclined, because I know your brother plays some instruments, your sister won a huge show.
Yeah, she was Voice of Nigeria.
Yeah, Voice of Nigeria many years ago now. You were into music and all of that, but you basically took that big leap of faith and opened a physical space about a couple of years ago now.
Yes. Yeah, so officially, I opened up the location I'm at right now. Finished construction. When did I finish? The end of 2021.
Okay.
And then I opened up shop like January 2022. So I did 1 year, 2 years. This is my third year in business officially. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, and opening up this space, I was operating out of the house for a good 10 years from 2013.
Okay, so I want to speak to now acknowledging that you are a business, investing in that physical space is a whole different mindset.
Yes.
You know, what does it feel like to be an entrepreneur? Because right now you have bills that are associated with your business that don't necessarily blend back into having a studio at home.
Yeah, it's stressful. But, you know, this is the life I chose, and also the life that chose me. And I also feel like this is just, it was almost just meant to happen in some shape or form, because my dad is a businessman. And since I was young, I was always doing something.
Okay, I want us to hold that thought.
Okay.
And because I'm recording you, I want to give you so many problems when you're going to be editing this. So the timer just went off, and that was for your hot oil treatment.
Okay.
So I'm going to try. Usually when I record, I try to do everything in one spot.
Okay.
So I don't give you so much headache.
Okay.
But since you are the one who is on the podcast today, I'm going to move us to the bowl so that I can rinse the treatment off your hair, and then we would move again.
No problem.
So I don't need to pause it, right? You would bring us back when you're ready to bring us back. And we are back. So this might be a little bit noisy, but I guess E will have the privilege of reducing the sounds we don't want to hear. But when we're talking about entrepreneurship and the fact that you were born into an entrepreneurial family. So your dad has always been a businessman. And that kind of inspires, I'm guessing it inspired you to continue along these lines.
I would say it kind of runs in the blood. And like I said, goes back to when I was young. In elementary school, I used to, then dating myself, this is before MP3 players, I used to burn songs off of LimeWire, download songs on LimeWire, and make people mix playlist CDs. Sell them for $5 a pop. I started that in fifth grade. I did it all throughout middle school and some of high school. But by high school, no one was really using CDs like that. So then I found something else. In my county, they banned selling sodas in the vending machine until after school.
Oh.
That was some new initiative.
To get you guys off sugar?
Yeah, just for healthiness, trying to kill, stop obesity, things like that. So what I did was fill that gap. I would go to Costco with my mother, use my own money to buy the sodas in bulk. It was like $6 for 32 cans. And then I would sell soda for $1 a can.
You know, so that's like $32 on every,
you know what I mean?
$6.
And I would do different flavors and all of that. And I keep evolving it. So at one point, people are like, okay, but it's not cold. So I said, don't worry. So I started getting Ziploc bags full of ice and storing the sodas like that. And I just come in my early business. It wasn't a lot much I was making, but it was something. You know, at 14, when you can't really work a proper job,
yeah,
I was doing something. And it wasn't like I was selling drugs or anything. So it was like, it's clean money.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And at this point, I know I'm aware that you are looking to expand.
Eventually. So I'm always thinking, you know, years ahead. I'm finally just sort of like, you know, we're talking about the whole when the business is really real now. So with the whole rent situation, that was like a huge, like, new expense I have to deal with on a monthly basis. So the first 2 years of business were kind of tumultuous for me. But this, where I'm at now, things are finally, you know, turning their head where, like, it's like,
yeah,
I'm running the business is not running me.
Mm-hmm. I actually think 2 years is a very good mark. So for someone who's had a business for 9 years now, I would say my 2 year mark running Locketude in Nigeria was one of those moments where I felt like, okay, I think I could do this. Yeah. I think this is real. I think this is sustainable. So I think you are there. You can sit up for me. One of the things, we're going to move again. So okay. let's see how well we move without reading things. All right, you can sit.
All right.
Oh, finally made it to our final position. Should I do this while I'm recording other people or just stay in one place?
Whatever works, can always edit it out.
Okay.
Or I may just keep it for authenticity, you know? Like,
yeah. Oh, wow. You really got hot oiled. So I could just see, like, the line, the cap.
It's almost like, you know, when you go to sleep with a durag on, it's too tight.
Yeah. Oops. Hopefully it clears before the end of the appointment. Yeah, so I was saying that the 2 year mark for me was like that mark where I was like, okay, yeah, I think I can really do this. I think this is a real business. I think I'll be okay. I think it's going to be all right. So I'm just putting the word out there on behalf of E. If you are an audio engineer looking to, you know, be part of an awesome business, E, the Mastermind Studios, is open and ready to start taking applications so that we'll consider them to expand.
You mean like one even like 1 or 2 months just before? Just
it's always good to get ready in advance.
It is.
Yeah.
I just need to just
it's always good to get ready in advance. So yeah. One of the things we've connected on since I've known you going on 3 years now.
Yes.
Going on 3 years has been books. We've shared a lot of audiobooks that we have both read. And one of the ones I feel like I enjoyed sharing with you was The Richest Man in Babylon.
Yes.
Do you still read that book every now and again? I haven't read it again this year.
I have to go over it again. Because, you know, when I listen to audiobooks, the first time through, it's like, okay. But for me, I like to repeat and repeat. So I still have to do a second run through. But at the time of doing that book, I also did some other, you know, finance books and stuff at the same type of time. And, you know, it just kind of put my mindset, you know, on that path. And to this day, like even today, for example, as my funds drop into, you know, my account, I'm always taking out 10% and trying to stow it away. You know, or what I'm kind of doing now is I'm not saving necessarily, but I'm taking 10% and putting it towards credit cards. Because before I start saving, I wanna just destroy my credit card debt. And I went into a lot of credit card debt when opening up the business because it was so many
capital intensive.
Yeah, unexpected things that hit me.
All right, let's move on to another particular issue. So I am aware that you have a medical condition. And I honestly don't know how to pronounce it. So you're going to have to help me.
I can help you with that. So it's pronounced scleroderma.
Scleroderma.
Yes, which is Latin-based for hard skin because the condition causes scarring or fibrosis, is the medical term. And, you know, you can get hardened skin and other issues like circulation issues, where your fingers or toes are not getting the blood supply they need. And that can result in some, that's called Raynaud's syndrome. And that can result in basically dead fingers or a lot of pain. There's only different symptoms I can go on and on about with this condition. But this condition is even part of the reason why I'm in the position I'm in now. Because I had to leave school early because of the condition, come home, And then because I couldn't work certain jobs, I just started recording in the house.
Well, how did it start? How many years have you lived with this condition now?
So it's about 12 years now. The first time I noticed this symptom, but it couldn't, who knows, may have started even a little bit earlier than that. But the first time I noticed, you know, symptoms of it was 2012, which is my high school graduation year. And it was, matter of fact, just around, kind of around prom time, around the very end of the senior year. Like, as I was taking exams, I was noticing these issues. So some of these issues, some of the first issues were the Raynaud's syndrome, which is the lack of blood flow to the fingers. So it'd be a warm, sunny day, and my fingers, it's like I have frostbite. Mm. And I didn't know what was going on. You know, I just knew my fingers were cold, and that was that. The time I knew something was kind of really weird was one of my fingers was hard. Literally,
just like, felt hard.
It literally hard. Like, you know, if you push on your finger, it's soft and supple. You can massage it. This was like, it's rock hard. So like, I tap one of my softer fingers on the table, you know, silent, like it should be. I tap a pencil on the table. It makes noise. You hear a pencil do. Then I tap the hard finger on the table, and it kind of sounded like the pencil. So I'm like, you know, this is...
That's hard.
Yes, it's that hard.
Could you bend it at the time? Or was it stiff?
At the time, it wasn't stiff. Now my fingers, a lot of them I can't bend. So that is, you know, part of the progression of the condition. The term for that is sclerodactyly, something like that. But at the time, I could bend it, but it was hard. It was hard. So that's when I knew something was wrong. Wasn't much to look into at first. I also had these weird, it looked like internal bruising underneath the nail bed. And I didn't know what it meant. But every time doctors saw it, it's like they kind of knew. But every time doctors saw it, they'd be like, oh no, he's too young. You know, because apparently it's type of condition, autoimmune condition that, you know, only older people get. And I was 18 at the time. So those are the early symptoms. You know, I just deal with the finger circulation. And it was like almost kind of like, okay, whatever. Then I go to college. I go to Chicago, off at school. And everything is good at first. But then the disease starts attacking my muscles. So scleroderma can affect the muscles. But they say I had an overlap of myositis. So muscle disease as well. Mind you, in high school, I played football. I was about 5'11", 185 pounds or so. So my older pictures, I'm very, like, you know, muscle-bound type of guy. By the time I left Chicago, after 1 year of school, at my lowest weight, I was about 120 or so, maybe 125.
So about 60 pounds gone.
Yeah, and a lot of it was muscle.
Within a year.
A lot of it was muscle. The disease was progressing rapidly.
And you were eating fine?
I was eating fine. All that was good. But it was just, over time, things were just like... And the funny thing is, I diagnosed myself early. You know when
you self-diagnosed?
I self-diagnosed online.
So you kind of found out what was wrong with you?
I thought it was scleroderma since the beginning because of the hard finger, because nothing else fit that description. But the one rheumatologist I saw at first was like, oh, no, you're too young. The blood tests say you don't have scleroderma. You probably just have Raynaud's syndrome. You probably don't want to go to Chicago for school because it's cold. Consider going to Florida. And that was that. You know, and it happens with a lot of people with autoimmune conditions. You don't get diagnosed for quite some time.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until, you know, I'm falling in the streets of Chicago because my legs are giving out and I'm having shortness of breath just going up the steps because the muscles around my chest are weak. And, you know, in the gym, I couldn't do certain exercises. And even after I dropped the weight, I realized my range of motion was just finished. I could barely even raise my arm. That's when we knew, all right, it's time to go revisit this again. Saw somebody else. He said, yeah, you probably do have scleroderma. I don't know how to treat it, and you're so young. I'm going to send you to Johns Hopkins. But Johns Hopkins, you kind of have to wait a while to get an appointment. So the earliest one was like 3 or 4 months down the line. So which happened to be right after I left school. So I came back. Hopkins takes less than 3 minutes for them to diagnose me. It just touched my like skin and everything. And they said, oh, yeah, yeah, you have scleroderma. I'm like, see, I thought so. But they're like, the blood test, they're like, the blood test don't matter. Some people have those markers, some people don't. But you have all the clinical signs of scleroderma. So we're going to start you on this infusion treatment called IVIG and this medication called CellCept, which is usually used for like people who have organ transplants.
Mm.
But I guess in my case, it's like it's supposed to weaken the immune system to stop it from attacking itself. So that was like the beginning of my journey, 2013. And it was...
Let's back it up a little bit. So the condition itself, according to what today's science knows, or from even 12 years ago when you were diagnosed officially, it's basically your immune system attacking your muscles or your skin.
Correct, basically. It's yes.
And the medication they put you on is to weaken your immune system.
Yes. However, the infusion that I use actually fortifies the immune system. It's like if you had an immunocompromise, they use that. They don't necessarily know whether infusion works, but it does. Mm-hmm. So that one doesn't weaken my immune system, but it helps fight like inflammation and everything.
Okay, so you are not like more susceptible to falling sick with this infusion?
So with the medication, they say you can be. I haven't noticed any difference, to be honest. And with the infusion, that's supposed to also help fight infections.
So it's been 12 years of living with this condition. How often do you have to go in for infusions? What's that experience like? And let's talk about that then.
Okay. So that experience has changed over time. Initially, it was every 4 weeks. And I would have to go down to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. I'm lucky that I'm, you know, within 45 minutes driving distance. And it'd be Monday through Friday, and I'm sitting there for about...
A whole week.
I go in and out. So I wasn't in... I go there, get an infusion, go come back.
But you're basically being infused every day?
Yes. And then at
1 hour a day or...
The actual infusion was probably like 6 or 7 hours, but I could be there for longer because the medication might take some time.
They have to monitor you.
Yes, so I was waking up early and I'd be getting home after traffic and everything by like 5 p.m. God bless my mother and everybody else who used to help drive me up there. They'd give me Benadryl and Tylenol because that's just part of the regimen. Benadryl used to knock me out and make me drowsy and sleepy. But at some point, the research showed that you could infuse faster. So my infusions became shorter at some point.
Over the years?
Over the years. Where from that length of time, now I was only sitting there for 3 hours, you know, or 3.5 hours, I would say.
But you still have to be infused I was still going through the week.
Throughout the week. And
so literally, you're leaving 3 weeks of freedom, 1 week in the hospital.
Yes, basically. That's exactly how it was. You know, by the time I started working again, I had to let them know, like,
fourth week.
Every 4 weeks, I just cannot work, you know. So cause I would keep the IV in my arm, and I'd be drowsy and tired and just a whole lot. You know, it's an unpredictable schedule. So then at some point, it got easier. They found a home infusion, and because I tolerate the medication well, I was able to do my whole dose over the course of 2 days at the maximum rate. So now, you know, they come to me, I don't have to go anywhere. The infusion's about 3 to 4 hours, and I only do it over the course of 2 days. So I'm barely missing time out. And,
But you still have to do every 4 weeks?
No. So we gradually ramped it up. We went from every 4 weeks to every 6 weeks. And currently I'm every 8 weeks. Okay. So it that alone has kind of changed, you know, a lot for me.
Your flexibility.
Because before it was like every 4 weeks, I'm doing this thing for a whole week. and it's almost like, you know, it's almost right around the corner again. And now I almost kind of forget I even do infusions because I do it. And then I'm like, yo, when's, I think I have to look at my schedule. When is my next infusions? When was the last time I did it?
Yeah. How many people in the world are diagnosed with this condition? Do you know?
Don't quote me if I say 1 in 10,000.
Oh, really?
Or 1 in 100,000. It's probably 1 in 100,000 or something like that. Maybe even more. I don't know. I just know it's rare. I know it's rare, and it affects Black people more than other people.
Other races.
It affects women more, and it affects Black people more than other races.
Was there any family history of it before you were diagnosed?
No family history of it. And from all the questions I've asked, they have not really made any genetic link to it.
Okay, so even, do they know what causes it at this point?
Not at this point. There's all sorts of theories out there, you know.
Vitamin D deficiencies?
People, there's different camps all doing their research. You know, a lot of it is like, what's the word I'm looking for? Not like always mainstream. You know, so you have independent groups or scientists. Some people are saying a lot of it has to do with the gut microbiome. A lot of people are saying it has to do with a combination of factors. So genetic is one part of it, but then your genes express a certain way once you're exposed to some type of chemical or, mm-hmm. you know, a diet or some sort of, you know, reaction. So some people say, you know, at some point your gut lining maybe is damaged. And then you have proteins from food flowing into your system that start to confuse the immune system. And that's how it starts to
attack itself or attack the body instead. Yeah. All right. So going through all of this started at the age of 18, with almost 12 years now, I can only imagine the mental turmoil that could come with this sort of condition. How have you been able to cope with all of it? Because you were active, fit, playing football, and this thing just disrupted your life, stealing a week from you every 4 weeks. And so that's kind of like a lot to deal with and to have dealt with it for a very long time. How has that journey been for you? And what do you do to keep it going?
Let me try and keep this as not long-winded as
please go ahead.
As possible.
Go ahead. Nobody's going to charge us for the time. You might charge me for the time to edit it.
I will preface this by saying I do have one little blog post out that I made 10 years ago. That's out on, it's called shiftedscope.com. And if you click my story of scleroderma, I kind of highlight a lot of things in detail. But dealing with that at the time was a lot. At the time, with the type of attitude, I'm a very like go-getter, like whatever comes my way, I'll deal with it. I kind of, you know, shrugged it all off almost. It was kind of like, all right, when I got diagnosed, I still remember it. It was June 2013. And then like they come in and like, yeah, you have this incurable disease that is rare and yada, yada, yada. It can kill you. You have a very severe form. If you don't act now, you know, your lungs might be scarred and you could die, you know. But the good news is if we attack it early, you have a very good chance of, you know, recovering pretty well. And in my head, I'm like, okay, like, I heard you, but, you know, like, let's get to it then. You know, like, no worries. But I even asked them one time, like, do you think I can get all my range of motion back and things like that? And they were saying, like, probably not. And I was like, that's not the answer I want to hear. Like, I don't care. Like, I'm going to make the impossible happen. I was very, like, optimistic at first. But then reality set in. Pretty quickly, 2013, I always call it the lost year because it was just dark for me, you know. So a lot was happening at once. not only could I have to, did I have to leave school after finally, like, you know, moving to Chicago, living on my own and having all these plans to make money while I'm out there. I always wanted to get a motorcycle. That never happened. You know what I mean? I had a long-term girlfriend. Now, mind you, there were some other issues going on, but this was like the icing on the cake that just made everything difficult to deal with. So that started shaking. The biggest thing too, I always say I went from doing handstands to now I can't stand. Because, you know, right before all this was happening, like that summer, like I was athletic as it gets. You know, I'm the type of guy who had a barbell in the house. I was waking up early, doing 3 to 5 miles, like every other day, lifting, all sorts of diets to bulk up and, you know, cut and bulk. I was a bodybuilder, you know, I was doing all of that. Like, I was athletic as it gets. And then all of a sudden, it's like, it's hard to get out of bed. So when my muscles were highly inflamed at first, at the highest, like the most severe I was with the condition, if I drop something, I can't bend down and get it. That was it. Like, I would drop things, but I would drop things in the supermarket sometimes and like just be looking at it. But it's almost like people had a sixth sense and would help me pick it up.
Hmm.
You know, there were so many little things that as I got better and better, I was always just feeling grateful that I could do.
You could do it because you know,
at my worst, I don't know what you call it, but the thing you use to like twist the blinds,
mm-hmm.
to open it up or close them, I couldn't reach up and twist that. You know, I would have to like hold one arm up with the other while twisting it because I couldn't lift my arm. I couldn't lift my own arm. When I had to walk up the steps, I had to put each foot on each step. I couldn't go like one step, next step, next step. I'm holding onto railings. I would avoid going upstairs if I could, going up and down the stairs. So for some time, I was basically bedridden. You know, I was basically bedridden. Even getting out of bed, I had to lift my legs out of bed. They were heavy. I can't explain it. I don't know how to explain it to you, but my head, it's like my legs were heavy. I could not lift them. Like, imagine laying down and you can't lift your leg. That's how it was. I couldn't, like, because I couldn't raise my, like, you know, step up or, like, you know, raise my foot, I had to, my shower in the house was one of the, it was like a bathtub, so it was quite some height. I couldn't get into that, so I had to use another shower where, like, it's just flat ground. Some of these memories I'm even having to, like, think about because it's like grayed out of my head. Mentally, it was like I was kind of accepting where I was at. I was like, well, I've traveled the world. I've lived a lot of life that other people haven't had because my life was kind of fast in high school. That's another story for another day. But I had a lot of experiences, you know, so I felt like, all right, even if this is it and my time is coming soon, I've lived well.
Mm.
You know, but I kept carrying on. It was music got me through. I wrote a lot of music during that time. I even just recently released that music on a project called The Chronic Phoenix.
Is it on Spotify,
Apple Music? Either Mastermind. The EP is called The Chronic Phoenix. Most of those songs were written during this time. They were produced and written during that 2013, 2014 sort of time. And then I wrote more as I went. So with that project, you can almost kind of feel what I was feeling as I went through my journey. Because it was like at some point, it's almost like, all right, I'm ready to die. Like, it's not the type of life to live. But like I said, I kept pushing on. I credit a lot to my supportive family, my supportive friends. My mother is big part of the equation. She never faltered. It's great. It's great. It's even kind of hard to think about where my head was exactly. I'm almost kind of far removed from that time. But it shaped who I am today. I had certain views and whatnot before that, and afterwards, you know, I was humbled. I was greatly humbled.
Do you mind sharing one of the views that humbled you?
So prior to that, I guess you could say I was somewhat of an elitist. You know, I had a lot of grand views. I always had ways of thinking, like, you know, I had this whole idea of like utopia and how do we make the world a better place. You know, a lot of my mindset too was like, you know, let the strong survive, let the weak go, essentially. It was kind of, you know, extreme type of views. And then it's like at some point, I'm the weak. But I was still holding on to those ideas. In my head, I'm like, well, if I'm the weak, then I gotta go. You know what I mean? But, you know, when you're humbled like that, you start to shift and you're like, all right.
It's okay to be weak.
Yeah, you can't just reduce things to that sort of like thinking.
Huh.
Like there's something to be said about people supporting each other and making up for whatever weaknesses you have. Like you still maintain your strengths even when you have weaknesses. You know, so for me, my strengths were still my strengths, you know, my skill set, all of that. You know, I was still a useful human being, so to speak. Even though at times I felt very useless. You know, I was kind of raised hyper independent, I would say. You know, like I learned how to cook my first meal at like 5, things like that. You know what I mean? And I like to do things by myself. So by the time I'm like independent, it was kind of sickening for me. Like it was conflicting for me. I'm like, this isn't it. But I would say that everything kind of even made me a better person. When I was how I was before, at the peak of things, I would say, like of, you know, right before the condition hit me, I was popular in high school. You know what I mean? And I got the girls. No one would ever try and fight me because I was strong. I was a strong dude. I could defend myself. I felt like I was on the top of the world. I was smart. I was in the gifted and talented programs. You know what I mean? Like, it was like, you know, even in middle school, I was voted most likely to be president. Like, as far as I'm concerned, I was on my way to running the world. Like, so I had some ways I had sort of an ego to me. And all of this brought me back down to earth, you know, helped me connect better spiritually. And
okay, so when you say help you connect better spiritually, you haven't really mentioned like God in all of this yet. Do you mind me asking if you believe in God?
I do believe in God.
Okay.
No, I would say more like one of those people who considers themselves more like spiritual than like by the book. But I do align with Christianity if I'm to align with anything. It's not like I didn't pray to God before, but it afterwards, everything, it was just like, you know, you start asking questions like, why me?
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
What I
and
do.
And then, like, as I guess, spiritually grew or just, I was just mentally fortified, I stopped asking, why me? And I'm like, why not me? You know? I'm like, it's me because I can handle this. If it was somebody else, maybe they wouldn't be able to handle it.
Yeah.
You know, I think about what type of path I would go down if I was the way I was before. And it could be very different. You know, I once had one of my friends say to me that, you know, you, what did he say? He said, like, because even though my body changed and everything, I was still, like, I still acted like who I was before. And who I was before, like, when you're that big, you don't even realize it, but you can somewhat do things or say things and not realize you're being rude or anything because nobody's calling you out on it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize, you know, that's how things were. But, like, when I'm a smaller guy and I might act a certain way, you know, people will say things. Like my friend once said, like, yo, like, with the way you're acting, if you were a bigger guy, your type of guy, someone would just shoot. Because, you know what I mean? They're not going to fight you, so they're just going to shoot you or whatever. And things like that, you know, made me look at my character more. And, you know, like, being smaller and not having that option of, like, all right, if someone gets slick, like, you know, I'm going to just use brute force against them to, like, intimidate or whatever. We become a lot more, I don't want to use the word political, but, you know, you learn how to respect people more and just all around things made me a well-rounded person.
Right.
Like, and they made me, these experiences, they took me to a place that most people won't get to their old.
Right.
You know, I've been through the gauntlet of experiences and, you know, emotions and everything. I start to understand people. So I look at some people and I'd be like, oh, I understand why this person's like that. It's not their fault. They don't realize, you know.
So do you feel like living with this condition helps you give people around you more grace? So if you are around somebody who is where you were before the condition, does that make you, like, look at them and go, like, okay, I see where you are.
Yeah.
You'll grow up.
I do. Now, whether or not they'll grow up, I don't know. Because, prime example, you can look at a lot of, like, some of these celebrities and whatnot, and it's that same type of thing. If you move a certain way and it's always just kind of been like that for you, you get used to it. And you think that's just, like, everything is okay, even everything's not okay.
Yeah.
You know, when you see how you've been at different levels in society, you see things, you just understand things at different levels and you behave accordingly. But I'm just able to just look at people and just kind of, I'm better with psychology because of all the psychology I've had to do it myself.
Did you ever see a therapist to help you on this journey?
So I didn't see a therapist until, like, what was it, around, was it 2018, 2019? So, for the longest time, I was not doing therapy. People were saying, yeah, I'll do therapy. I'm like, I don't need therapy. I'm like, what's therapy going to do for me? It wasn't until, at some point, I ended up getting into another relationship. And, that can be a whole story in and of itself because that was just a very, like, messy sort of, it was more like a situationship than an actual relationship. And that and other combination of factors just messed me up in the head. And then, like, had me questioning a bunch of things and, like, you know.
Ugh.
I don't even know where to begin with that. But long story short, when that relationship was now, like, ending, my head was just very, like, screwed up. And I started having a lot of strange thoughts, like, yo, like, I think I just want to die or whatever. But I knew, like, I'm too prideful for, like, suicide or anything like that. Trigger warning. I don't really do trigger warning, but, you know, I guess we could say trigger warning.
I guess.
But, yeah, so my head was just in a very weird space where it just kind of, like, you know, more like passive, like, I wouldn't much mind dying. So I'm like, you know what? This type of thinking is atypical for me. And I guess it's try to just try something new. So I found a therapist. The first one I found worked for me. And honestly, it's not even so much the therapist did so much for me, but I'm very much the type of person who I think out loud. And so,
talking to somebody was all you needed.
Yeah, and you know, the little perspective here and there helped a lot, and just it made me feel like I'm doing something. Okay, and then I was consistent with it, and I think I believe it did help, because I started using my therapist person as an accountability person. Okay. So it's like, let me not come in here talking about the same thing I was talking about last time. And let me
change something about it.
Let me, you know, let me make some progress. So that ended up helping. And I would say I basically graduated from therapy sometime last year. And now I just kind of like every now and then I just
check in,
make an appointment just to make an appointment. You know, because I once saw somewhere that it's like, you know, you go to the dentist routinely to make sure you don't have,
you don't have to go to the dentist.
Because you have period, I can't say it, periodontitis, you know what I mean? So you want to go before the problem's there. So I just kind of, you know, just to go, just to make it a thing to go. But yeah, I would say that's when I finally tapped into therapy. And it was helpful for me. Because it was like, if anything, it just put me in a mindset of proactivity. It's like, let's not just let my thoughts start going to a negative loop and controlling me. Let me control my thoughts.
Okay, so having gone from, and it's been a while since you've lived and managed this condition. And I met you very similar to how you look now. The question I'm trying to ask is, being somebody who is now like physically vulnerable, where on a bad day you might not be able to have that full range of motion, you know, or do things that you would normally do, how do you cope with people feeling sorry for you? Is it something that is welcome? Is it something you experience a lot? Do people just automatically, you know, feel sorry for you? And how do you cope with
that?
So
at first, when things were obvious, you know, there was a lot more of that, especially when someone's just seeing me for the first time. And it's like,
yeah, what happened?
You know, like funny stories, when I first came back home, I'd see people in the mall, wherever, I'm like, yo. They'd be looking at me like, what?
They didn't
recognize me. You know what I mean? They're like, oh, they're like, whoa, what happened, man? You know what I mean? Sort of thing. But I'm the type of person who highly dislikes pity. You know, I hate it. Like, I hate it. Like, do not feel sorry for me. So at some point I learned to like not even talk about what I'm going through. It's either someone notices and asks questions, or they don't notice, and it is what it is. But anytime I did tell my story or something, it wasn't to receive pity. It was just kind of, I'm just letting you know. Like, if you're going to know me, it's part of who I am now. But I don't want your pity. Like, don't feel sorry for me. But the thing is, it's such a... I got used to, you know, my hope. But for some people hearing it, it just makes them sad. You know, they have no choice but to feel something. But, you know, I made it a thing of just being strong for others so they can feel like they don't have to pity. You know what I mean? So I let it be that my story is a source of inspiration, not like, oh, poor baby sort of thing. You know what I mean? I'm like, look. Yeah, this is what I went through, but I'm still trudging along.
Yeah.
You know, I'm still doing what I'm doing, like, you know, I'm making moves.
If anything, from my perspective, I don't think I ever felt sorry for you since I met you.
And but also you had your own experience, so it was almost like we were speaking on the same level. Like,
yes.
Why should we be feeling sorry for me, I'm feeling sorry for you. It's like, okay, you understand.
Yeah.
You understand, like, you know.
So it's an interesting place to be. So, well, we've spoken a lot about this condition. And the truth is that sometimes people are going through things that you cannot even see. Like, in your condition, it might be noticeable that, you know, especially like you said, in that first time.
Yeah.
When you lost a lot of weight and lost muscle, people who knew you before, you know.
Yeah.
But everybody oftentimes is going through something.
Exactly. And that's something that it taught me as well. So yeah. I'm just like, you know, don't be out here, woe is me, because the person you're woe is me might have something they're not talking to you about.
Yeah. Know? All right. Let's change the subject. Audiobooks. Which one are you listening to right now?
So I actually have not been playing audiobooks for some time.
Oh.
Because I've been so booked and busy in the studio.
Good.
So it's like, I work with audio. I always say, because I work with audio, it's hard to listen to audio.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to listen to new music. It's hard for me to listen to audiobooks.
It's funny that you say that. So my spouse believes that me making my own hair should feel like self-care. And I'm like, no, that's one. I need somebody else to help me get my hair done. I'm not going to sit down in front of the TV and be pampering myself by doing my own hair. No. Yeah. But any good ones you listened to recently?
The last good one, let me use the word profound, was The Courage to be Disliked. I cannot remember the author name right now, but I like the format of the book, where it's like a, you know, teacher guru type of guy talking to like a young boy. And the way that it kind of flows is the guy will make a controversial statement like, trauma does not exist, right? And the boy now responds like most people would respond, sort of like, what do you mean trauma doesn't exist? So what about yada, 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 yada? And it's like, you know, as they're making points, they're presenting the counterpoints in a creative way and then addressing those counterpoints. So it's as an argument, with the arguments they're making in the book, they're presented quite well. And
what's the essence of the book? Because it says the courage to be disliked. So does that mean the courage to be unagreeable?
So the book covers a lot of different things. I cannot tell you why exactly it had that title.
Okay.
At the moment.
Maybe.
I gotta do maybe another listening through. But I just know that in several different sections, it discussed a lot of things that I also sort of speak on or believe in. So it kind of resonated with me as just, okay, these are things that I kind of came to know or observe, and I hear somebody else presenting it with more substance. So I'm like, okay, this book has something in it. It's a good way to if you want to have someone with a different perspective, it's a good book to engage in. So
I actually like the title.
Some of the things that it talked about was, you know, people being holding on to the past too much and letting that control them. It talked about another part of the book talked about, there's so many different sections.
Yeah, I'll definitely put it on my list.
Just people-to-people relations and how, like, you shouldn't try to be liked by everybody. So that's where the title comes into play. There's a part where it does talk about that and how, you know, when you're trying to be liked by everybody, you become inauthentic. And you know, being inauthentic is not the way to a fulfilled life, you know. So that part resonated with, because that was a big game changer for me in my life when I recognized that when you're inauthentic, you make inauthentic connections. And if you live with inauthentic connections, at some point you're going to be like, you know, who am I? Who are these people that I'm with? You know what I mean? So it's good to be real, even if being real means that you might ruffle some feathers. You might be disliked. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're still listening at this point, you've literally gone through the entire hair appointment with us. We've gone from the hot oil treatments to the bowl, to the chair, gotten the twist done, lost power somehow, even though we're not in Nigeria.
That power is everywhere.
Lost power in the middle of the podcast, but well, it wasn't actual power that went out, but the batteries went out. It's been a great conversation. But before I wrap it up, I want to ask one last question. 12 years in, do you feel normal?
Do I feel normal? I feel more normal. But I would answer the question by saying that I've since forgotten what normal is.
This is the normal?
All I know is me. And, you know, I'm still me at the end of the day.
Okay, that's a very fair answer. And I know I'd already got away from that topic, got into books, so I will share one of the recent books that I finished recently, and I think I shared that with you already, The Alchemist. Yeah, I think that's the name of the book, The Alchemist.
Yes.
And I think it's a very old book.
They use it in school curriculum. It's that book's not going anywhere.
Yeah, I read it because I was going through the Instagram reel, and I tell myself I'm only on Instagram for the business, but I never post as often as I should for the business. And somebody talked about it, and I was like, okay, this might be a good audio listen. And I really enjoyed that book. Because what made me remember it was when you were speaking about the format of the courage to be disliked. It's kind of that guru.
Yes,
so it has kind of the same format. And it kind of took you on this journey where this guy makes this journey all the way to the foot of the pyramids in Egypt from, I can't remember exactly where his origin was, but he crossed the sea. He had all these experiences along the way. Only for what he was looking for was at home all along. So my takeaway from that book is kind of like, I'm just going to say Nigerian proverb-ish. We see defined for Sokoto, day for your Shokoto. Do you understand what that means?
I get it.
Kind of?
Yeah.
So Sokoto is a state which is up north.
Yeah.
Is one of the farthest states. It's on the border of Niger. And Sokoto in Yoruba means your pants.
Yeah.
So it's like you travel all the way to Sokoto to go look for this thing. And meanwhile,
you've had it there since.
It's all in your pants. So like, it's in you. It's all in you. And whatever we're going through in life, it's kind of up to you. It's you who's going through it. It's you who makes those decisions. It's you who chooses to feel sorry or not sorry for yourself. It's you who chooses to wake up every day and take the next step, but try to keep it healthy. I'm speaking to myself too. Let us try not to walk ourselves into like oblivion or the grave.
Yeah, you gotta listen to your body. It all comes first. There's no you, there's no money, there's no love, there's no anything. You gotta keep you good first.
Yeah. But you know, sometimes it feels like you could keep you good if you have the money.
I understand that. Yeah, that's one of the conversations too.
Yeah, so this is a good place to end the podcast. I wonder how many hours we've done
running the parts
on this one. Well, this has been the Talking Locks with Locksuit podcast. I have had E, the mastermind, with me. We've talked about a lot of things, from music to his early childhood to me being on a record to all these fantastic experiences that we've shared, and his personal story having the condition called
scleroderma.
I have to like see it in words before I'll be able to pronounce it properly. But this has been the Talking Locks with Locksuit podcast, Chair Convo series. We got to go now. You can find us wherever you listen to your podcast. And I don't know if I mentioned this already on previous episodes, but we are also now on YouTube podcasts. I think Google Podcast is going away this June. So we are now on YouTube podcast. You can find our previous episodes there as well. Tell your friend about us, and hopefully we see you in the studio sometime, and we will be talking to you, and you'll be giving us some sweet hot gist about some conversations, or we'll be having some conversations about what's going on in your life as well. So I will shut up now and wrap it up, and don't forget to keep it locked with an attitude. Yeah.